Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the oil report of the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, January 10th. Shale lessons for 2026. Price matters less as efficiency rises. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Unconventional shale has been revolutionizing the Permian Basin and the U.S. for over two decades, but continues to school operators. As 2025 came to an end, Primary Vision detailed three key takeaways from shale during the year. First, longer and larger frack jobs are becoming more common. Second, production trends are shaped by far more than oil prices alone, with technology, automation, and AI improving planning, execution, and recovery rates. Third, U.S. shale has focused on unlocking more oil through improved consumables and more efficient deployment of horsepower capacity, weakening the traditional linkage between price signals and short-term activity. Quote, "The three key takeaways are definitely applicable for companies. This holds special relevance and importance when deciding budgets or assessing the health of the market in 2026, Osama Rizvi, energy and economic analyst at Primary Vision, told the Reporter Telegram. Continuing the quote, "It also helps policymakers and decision-makers in the company to focus on the right factors. For instance, not obsessing only about price, but also looking at the technological advancements, horsepower deployment, size, and duration of frack jobs. It gives them a holistic view," end quote. Primary Vision said its frack spread count ended the year at 154, down 6 for the final week of 2025, while its frack job count remained steady. This macro backdrop carried into Primary Vision's work on the oilfield service industry, where it created an OFS ranking, a scorecard highlighting which business models are best positioned in the current cycle. Technip FMC stood out as the clearest structural leader, followed by Halliburton and NOV on execution and diversification. Pressure-focused names remained constrained. ProFrac illustrated the challenge well, improving operations and cost control, but still screening expensive versus peers because structure ultimately caps upside. Midland-based ProPetro was ranked as overvalued. Quote, "Here's the logic for overvaluation. Let's compare ProPetro, whose stock ticker is PUMP, with some of its close competitors, Patterson-UTI, Liberty, and Nabors. PUMP's EV/EV/ITDA multiple expansion, forward multiple versus current, is 10%, which is much steeper than the peer's average of 2%, meaning PUMP's EBITDA should fall more sharply than its peers. This should typically result in a lower EV/EBITDA multiple than its peers. But PUMP's current EV/EBITDA of 5.4 times is higher than its peers' average of 4.6 times. So it looks pricey," explained Avik Bana Chaudhuri, financial analyst at Primary. Chaudhuri said the OFS ranking model examines companies on multiple criteria, starting with management's tone in the outlook, projects during the quarter, backlog confidence, revenue growth, margin expansion, contraction, and capital discipline. Quote, more importantly, it tries to capture the business model diversity. So, SLB's diversified model can carry more weight than Pump's relatively narrow business structure. We have also assigned a higher weight to the mobile electricity generation route, which some pressure pumpers have adopted. We considered all these variables over the past several quarters, starting with the first quarter of 2024, and accounted for the progress. Then we assigned weights and ranked them, hopefully achieving a level playing field and consistency in the process. We will update the model as we move forward, Chidori said. Battalion Oil to sell West Quito Draw assets for $62.5 million. The story was written by Mella McEwen, Oil editor. Battalion Oil Corporation is selling substantially all of its properties in the West Quito Draw area of Ward County to MCM Delaware Resources for approximately $62.5 million. In a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Battalion said the properties include approximately 6,207 net acres. Proved reserves from these properties accounted for approximately 8 million barrels of oil equivalent, or approximately 12% of the company's 2024 year-end proved reserves. The effective date of the proposed sale is December 1, 2025, and the company expects to close the transaction in the first quarter of 2026. Battalion said in its filing it intends to use the net proceeds from the divestiture of the West Quito assets, if such transaction closes, to repay amounts outstanding under the company's senior secured credit agreement and for general corporate purposes, including funding potential acquisitions and planned drilling expenditures. Pursuant to the terms of the agreement, MCM paid into escrow a deposit totaling approximately $6.2 million, which amount will be applied to the purchase price if the transaction closes. Battalion said in its filing the parties may terminate the agreement if certain closing conditions have not been satisfied or if total adjustments to the purchase price exceed 20% of the purchase price, approximately $12.5 million, or the transaction has not closed on or before March 26, 2026. Wall Street Sand launches dry sand operations. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Wall Street Sand Company has reached a significant milestone at its Kermit frac sand facility. The company, founded in 2023, has launched dry sand operations at the facility, allowing it to support the evolving completion needs of operators and service companies. Quote, our original focus was supporting wet sand in the Permian Basin. As we developed the site, we quickly recognized that the combination of exceptional in-situ sand quality, abundant on-site water, and unique process capabilities created an opportunity to build something fundamentally different than a traditional sand mine, Brandon Foster, Wall Street Chief Executive Officer, told a reporter Telegram. Expanding into dry sand wasn't a pivot. It was the natural evolution of a vertically integrated, innovation-driven system designed to serve customers efficiently in any market environment. End quote. According to Foster, Wall Street Sand was founded in 2023 with a limited liability corporation established that same year. The property was acquired and the company broke ground in April 2024. Quote, reaching full dry sand operations in that time frame is a significant milestone and reflects how intentionally this project was designed from the beginning, Foster said. The primary difference between wet sand and dry sand is moisture content and logistics, he said. Dry sand has gone through a full drying process and is essentially 100% sand. Wet sand typically contains about 5% moisture, meaning it's roughly 95% sand. Importantly, wet sand is still a high-quality propant. It's not mud or low-grade material. Both sands perform well downhole and are widely used across the Permian Basin, with the choice often dependent on completion design, logistics, and customer preference. Expanding into dry sand significantly expands workforce requirements across multiple disciplines. The facility includes 7 dedicated dry sand loadout lanes and over 100,000 tons of on-site dry storage, which requires skilled operators to run safely and efficiently, according to Foster. Quote, because we perform our own mining and processing, job creation spans loader operators, mining and excavator operators, plant operators, and dry plant specialists. As we continue to scale, this operation supports both direct employment and broader economic activity throughout the region, end quote. The company operates 48 water wells on site, extremely low turbidity sand, and high crush strength straight out of the ground. Those natural advantages are paired with Wall Street's patented prop thrust slurry and agitation process, allowing the company to produce an exceptionally clean, high-quality product at a structurally lower cost. Quote, we believe that cleaner sand improves placement efficiency, reduces operational friction during pumping, and ultimately contributes to stronger well performance, Foster said. From our perspective, delivering high-quality propane directly impacts well productivity and helps our customers achieve a higher return on their capital investments, end quote. Currently, he said, demand has been strong, driven by a combination of product quality, operational reliability, and sustainable cost competitiveness. As of today, more than 200,000 tons of Wall Street's dry sand are already contracted, despite having only recently entered the dry sand market. Quote, looking ahead to 2026, we forecast approximately 7.5 million tons sold across wet and dry sand combined. Roughly, half of that volume is already contracted, with the remainder expected to transact in the spot market. From an operational standpoint, we're built to support that scale. With 11 total loadout lanes, we maintain a steady, predictable cadence of trucks moving in and out of the facility. This is critical for efficiency, trucking retention, and customer reliability, Foster said. He concluded, quote, while overall industry activity may fluctuate, we believe suppliers with structurally advantaged cost positions, consistent quality, and dependable execution will continue to see demand. Our focus is on building a system that performs in both up cycles and down cycles, giving our customers confidence that we'll be a reliable partner regardless of market conditions, end quote. ProPetro's ProPWR wins Coterra microgrid deal in New Mexico. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. ProPWR continues to rack up contracts a year into operation. A division of ProPetro, ProPWR, has executed a contract to provide turnkey power for the development and installation of distributed microgrids throughout the New Mexico portion of the Permian Basin with a subsidiary of Coterra Energy Incorporated. Deployment and operations for the project are scheduled to begin in the first quarter of 2026. It is ProPWR's second contract in New Mexico, said Dave Bosco, ProPWR Vice President, Technical Services. He said the company is permitting the assets to meet New Mexico emissions regulations. He said in comparing emissions, ProPWR's equipment is 40% better than regulations. Matt Augustine, Vice President of Finance and Investor Relations, said ProPWR can help power assets across parts of the Permian Basin with limited or no access to the electric grid. The contract with Coterra's subsidiary is the fourth announced by the company, which now has 220 megawatts under contract. ProPWR has also placed orders for an additional 190 megawatts of equipment, bringing current delivered or on-order capacity to about 550 megawatts. Bosco said that is the equivalent of powering 300,000 to 330,000 homes. To reach 220 megawatts in roughly a year is exciting, the two men agreed. The equipment portfolio is split 70% high-efficiency natural gas reciprocating engine generators and 30% low-emissions modular turbines. Quote, beyond that, ProPWR is well-positioned to order additional capacity, said Augustine, who estimated capacity could reach 750 megawatts delivered by year-end 2028, and 1 gigawatt or more by 2030. Quote, we will continue to place assets where there's opportunity given the demand for power across the U.S., he said. We will continue playing in the oil field production microgrid space and data centers, end quote. Added Bosco, quote, we want to be in areas that are challenged with grid access and interconnectedness. End quote. Augustine acknowledged the company as a completion services provider has been affected by the slowdown in activity over the last 12 to 24 months. But, he said, we've created a resilient company. Bosco agreed, saying the company is transitioning from a traditional oil field services company to a next-generation company offering multiple lines of service. That transition will allow ProPWR to have a big impact on its parent company's bottom line, he said. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, January 15th. Joe Philip Liberty died at home on January 2nd. He was born in Big Spring, Texas on August 7, 1937, and grew up living on the family's cotton farm near Ackerley, Texas. Joe and his sister, Linda K. Dyer, attended the schools of the local area before attending and graduating from Big Spring High School. On the way to graduation from high school, Joe decided that his future lay in banking or investment management rather than farming, and that Texas A&M was the right place to start. The plan changed during his freshman year, however, when he realized how lonely and dark it could get hitchhiking from Bryan College Station back and forth to Big Spring to see his beloved girlfriend, Nancy King. A plan was soon hatched for them to marry in September 1957 and attend the University of Texas at Austin together in the fall. Nancy and Joe attended classes and worked together to build the foundation for her future, with Joe graduating with a concentration in economics and landing his first job in Houston with Rotan Mosel. Professionally, Joe was always committed to the long-term success of his clients. In his early Midland years, it was challenging to successfully position a slow and steady proposition of investing in such an entrepreneurial environment as Midland. Over the years, the success of his clients and his appeal to "just let me help you with your serious money" resulted in building his personal success into a successful team, the Liberty Group at UBS, from which he retired in 2014. Joe is preceded in death by his father, Gerald Liberty, parents Jean and Elmer Dyer, and wife Nancy K. Liberty. Joe is survived by his sister, Linda K. Dyer, sister-in-law, Sarah K. Webb, and husband Tom. Joe's two sons are Todd Liberty and his wife Martha, Blake Liberty and wife Chris, and a niece, Carrie Kent. Joe has five grandchildren. A celebration of life will be held at First Methodist Church on Wednesday, January 21st at 11 a.m. That evening, from 5 to 7 p.m., the family will host a reception for family and friends to celebrate Joe at the Petroleum Club. In lieu of flowers, please consider a memorial contribution to High Sky Children's Ranch, Midland Memorial Foundation, or the charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Marcia Smith Sullivan passed away on January 10th. Born in 1964 in Kansas, the family moved to Midland from Kansas when Marcia was 1 year old. She grew up in Midland and never left. Marcia graduated from Midland High School in 1982 and attended Midland College. She immediately went to work after graduation. Marcia is mostly known for working 13 years at the Midland County Tax Office as a tax deputy. In 1996, she ran for election for County Tax Assessor-Collector of Midland County. She also worked for the Midland County Central Appraisal District and South Plains Mortgage Company, where she was a loan processor. Marcia was a member of Kelview Heights Baptist Church. She was a member of the American Diabetes Association and former member of Make-A-Wish Foundation. Marcia was preceded in death by her parents, Wesley K. Smith and Jeannie Evelyn Still Smith, her brother, Toby J. Smith. She is survived by her husband, Danny R. Sullivan, stepchildren, Corey and his wife, Katie Sullivan, granddaughter, Kaylee Mae Sullivan, and grandson, Cody Lee Sullivan, Renee Sullivan Reyna and her husband, James, Selena Linsky and her husband Thomas, and grandson Seth. Donations can be made in Marcia's memory to Kelview Heights Baptist Church. Viewing will be Wednesday, January 14th, from 12 to 9 p.m. A funeral service has been set for Thursday, January 15th, at 10 a.m. at Kelview Heights Baptist Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel in Midland, Texas. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit the website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Peggy Jean Wood Brown, age 93, of Midland, peacefully passed away in the early morning of Sunday, January 11th, leaving behind a legacy of love, devotion, and cherished memories. Peggy was born on December 15th, 1932, in Sweetwater, Texas, to Charlie Van Brown and Frances Louise Brown. Peggy grew up on her family's ranch in Callahan County, Texas, with her parents and two younger brothers. After graduating from Cisco High School in 1950, Peggy married the love of her life, George Holmes Wood, in Cisco, Texas, in 1953. As the family moved around the country in support of George's career in the oil business, Peggy had a way of making every new city feel like home. They spent time in Burke Burnett, Texas, Ranger, Texas, Gillette, Wyoming, Casper, Wyoming, Midland, Texas, Hayes, Kansas, and eventually retired in San Angelo, Texas. She was preceded in death by her beloved husband, George Holmes Wood, her brother, Dwayne Brown, and her parents, Charlie Van Brown and Frances Louise Brown. Peggy is survived by her brother, Harold Dean Brown, her children, Michael Twig Wood and his wife Kathy, Timothy Wade Wood and his wife Deborah, and Terry Jean Luck and her husband Terry. She is also survived by several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held on Thursday, January 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A graveside service will follow on Friday, February 16th, at 2 p.m. at Oakwood Cemetery in Cisco, Texas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. It is with a heavy heart and great sadness we say goodbye to James L. Jim Petillo of Midland, Texas. He succumbed to a prolonged illness and passed away peacefully in Midland on December 28th. Jim was born in San Angelo, Texas, in 1942, to Rodney G. Tex Petillo and Mary Burnett Petillo. He grew up in Monahans, Texas, before moving to Lubbock, where he attended Texas Tech University. It was there he met and married the love of his life, Jane Ellen Jones Petillo. They were happily married 61 years. Jim was a proud Navy veteran of the Vietnam War. He was born and raised in the oil field, where he gained a reputation for being a great salesman. After retirement, Jim and Jane moved to Capitan, New Mexico. They were active members of the First Baptist Church of Ruidoso until recently when they moved back to Midland. At Jim's request, there will not be a funeral or memorial service. In a private ceremony, family will scatter his ashes in a horse pasture. He will ride like the wind toward heaven. He is survived by his wife, Jane, his daughter, Paige Walters of Florida, her husband, Joseph, and several grandchildren. He is also survived by his son, Scott Petillo of Midland, his wife, Carla, and also some more grandchildren. He leaves behind two great-grandchildren.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, January 10th, 2026. Religion. Is knowing and obeying God important to us? By William F. Holland, Jr., Ph.D., ordained and licensed Christian minister. At this time of year, we begin planning our intentions, as January marks a new beginning and is the ideal opportunity to implement physical, emotional, and spiritual lifestyle changes. C.S. Lewis is quoted, "You are never too old to set another goal or dream a new dream." You notice I used the word developing because whatever our goals, including drawing closer to God, is a process like losing weight, exercising, or any other vision we are focused on. For example, eating a salad today and resisting the pie is not going to automatically make us skinny, but it's a positive first step. Likewise, being determined to succeed is how we become more aware of God's voice. Are we spiritually in control of how we speak and act? Or do our carnal emotions control us? Are we seeking the easy way to solve our problems, or a lifestyle change that surrenders our thoughts over to God's will? One of our most powerful vows would be to dedicate time each day to prayer and meditation. If we are serious about personal transformation, we will seek God's help to guide us in the things we know we need to do or that we need to stop doing. For example, I heard someone say the other day that if a person is serious about conquering bad eating habits, they would ask God to help adjust their cravings. I agree. But what if the love of food is more powerful than their desire to become healthy? What if the person does not really want to surrender this powerful addiction? What if a person loves money, pornography, being lazy, selfish, abusing, or smoking, or alcohol, more than they care about what God thinks? Until the desire to change becomes more important than staying the same, our visions are nothing more than dreams. When the mind changes, the deeds and actions of the body will follow. No matter what people say, our body is God's temple, and the way we treat it is very important to Him. Do you believe that if we asked God to deliver us from our weaknesses, He would get involved? What if we sincerely asked the Lord that for every time we lusted to do something we know is a sinful, negative behavior, that He would make us nauseated? Too extreme, you might say. I believe this is how desperate we must become in order to break free from the chains that hold us in spiritual and mental bondage. Let's go ahead and try it. I dare us. The reverential fear of God includes having an awareness of His authority. Do we care that when we defy Him and allow sin to govern our lives, we are hurting Him? Do we care what He thinks or how much He's concerned about our wrong decisions? How much do we meditate on the reverential fear of God and the price He paid to redeem us from an eternal death? Spiritual obedience to God and accomplishing His desires come from the inside out. To change what is on the outside, we must first rearrange what is on the inside. When Christ is invited to sit on the throne of our hearts, to be the King and Master of our lives, only then can we comprehend what it means to take up our cross and follow Him. The refiner's fire is not just a religious slogan. It is a requirement to comprehend the difference between a religious masquerade and a personal, intimate relationship with Jesus. His salvation is not just Him being a Savior. This heavenly concept is founded on His desire to become our Lord. The question we are faced with is, do we really want to be a living sacrifice for Him? Read Romans 12, 1 and 2. Our lives are filled with as many distractions as we allow, and we can be as filled and as close to God as we want. We are servants to whom we obey. Romans 6, 16. How bad do we want God? Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "What lies behind us and what lies before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us." Romans 8:31 declares, "What then shall we say of these things? If God be for us, who can be against us?" Well, we know the devil is against us, but at the end of the day, our free will to choose is the only thing that can prevent what Christ died for us to be. Read more about the Christian life at BillyHollandMinistries.com. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Ancient meditation practices find new life in religious communities. From the Associated Press. On most Monday nights, the sanctuary of All Saints Episcopal Church, with its vaulted ceilings, stone arches, and stained glass windows, seamlessly transforms into a space of quiet contemplation. It's in this Gothic Revival church in Pasadena, California, that Betty Cole, a longtime Zen practitioner and card-carrying Episcopalian, leads a weekly interfaith group in seated and walking meditation. The group has evolved into a quiet fellowship since she started it in 2001, Cole said. It's mostly people who are really not very inspired by the liturgy, pomp, and music of the church, but do enjoy the building, the quiet of the chapel, and the sense of encouragement and accountability in that shared quiet, she said. Christian, Jewish, and other religious congregations across America have in recent years been introducing meditation practices from Eastern religions like Buddhism and Hinduism, or resurfacing ancient contemplative practices in their own religious traditions, now adapted to the needs of a fast-paced modern world. While longtime practitioners like Cole say these contemplative practices are inherently spiritual or religious, they recognize that mental health and social benefits are added attributes. In some deeply religious spaces, meditation has been disparaged as a gateway to the demonic. In some secular circles, it's debunked as superstition. Skeptics raise concerns over cultural appropriation, particularly in cases where Eastern practices have been marketed as trendy self-improvement. But nationwide, more people, religious and non-religious, seem to be showing more interest in such practices. Increasingly, houses of worship are encouraging a variety of contemplative practices. Connecting to ancient practices. Voices chanting Om, a sacred sound in several Eastern religions, blend with sounds of singing bowls, piano, and other instruments at meditation held in an Ivy League university chapel. A rabbi leads virtual meditation and breath work while drawing from Jewish scriptures. In the sanctuary of a Unitarian Universalist congregation, a group gathers to study Buddhist Dharma and to be enveloped in the meditative practice of a sound bath. Across centuries, meditation has been common in Buddhism, where the goal is to become enlightened like the Buddha, and Hinduism, in which the ancient spiritual practice of yoga is rooted. Contemplative and meditative practices in many religions seek to find a direct connection with God. That includes the desert fathers and mothers, early Christian ascetics who followed a form of meditation focused on silence in the Egyptian desert. It also includes Kabbalistic and Hasidic meditation techniques in Jewish tradition and the whirling dervishes in Sufism, a mystical movement within Islam. The next resurgence that we're seeing now is people moving all the way out from saying, I'm going to practice a religious tradition, into I'm willing to do some of the practices that exist within those traditions, said Lodro Rinzler, a Buddhist teacher and author of The Buddha Walks Into a Bar. For others, Rinzler said, it has helped rekindle a connection to their own religions and their ancient, lesser-known meditative practices. Some of the practices that have been spliced out and stand alone are now coming back under the umbrellas, he said. People are then being attracted to the traditions from which they've always been a part of. Meditation rooted in Jewish tradition. That's the case of the Or HaLev Center for Jewish Spirituality and Meditation. Launched in 2011 by Rabbi James Jacobson Meisels, it seeks to give people access to a meditation practice rooted in Jewish tradition. We're bringing Hasidic meditations and understandings to a contemporary audience, said Jacobson Meisels. We're also integrating that with Eastern traditions that have come from the West. These meditative practices, he said, are less known, mainly because of the effects of modernity and the Holocaust, which destroyed many communities and teachers who were preserving these traditions. As part of Jews' assimilation to the modern world, many parts of the mystical tradition got rejected or cast aside because they were related to as unacceptable, irrational, not fitting to the modern world, he said. Kabbalah was the most dominant theological paradigm in Judaism. But after modernity, it really was pushed to the side, he said. Now it's experiencing, once again, a resurgence. Music meditation at a university chapel. Many have gathered at the Princeton University Chapel to attend meditation events that include chamber music, breathwork, and the chanting of mantras. The feedback I've mostly gotten is that people say, I want to do that again. I don't know what happened, but I feel like whatever happened, I need more of it, said Hope Litwin, a composer who facilitates musical rituals for the meditations. People notice the mysterious quality and people feel changed by it, said Litwin, who is pursuing her PhD in music composition at Princeton. The university's Gothic non-denominational chapel hosts concerts, weddings, and interfaith services throughout the academic year. People from different religions, and even people with no religion at all, connect to meditation because meditation taps us into something universal, something deeper than belief systems or doctrines, said A.J. Alvarez, a meditation teacher. Buddhist meditation at a Universalist Unitarian congregation. Meditation also has become a crucial part of spiritual life at All Souls NYC, a Unitarian Universalist congregation. When the Reverend Pamela Patton, a Universalist and Buddhist, began the Mindfulness Meditation Buddhism program in 2016, she was unsure how it would be received. In a decade, though, it grew into a community of about 800 members, learning from teachers of different Buddhist lineages. The Universalist religious movement welcomes people with diverse spiritual beliefs. Regarding her program, Patton said, "It's brought a lot to our community." Features from the Bible. Truth in Scripture. Nathan rebukes David from 2 Samuel chapter 12. The Lord sent Nathan the prophet to David concerning his win with Bathsheba. Nathan told David a parable about two men. One man was rich and the other was poor. The rich man, who had many sheep and much cattle, took the only lamb of the poor man and fed a traveler with it. David was angry against the rich man in the parable and said to Nathan that the rich man deserved to die. Nathan said to David, "You are that man. You killed Uriah." Nathan then told David that the Lord would bring calamity upon him. David confessed his sin and the Lord forgave him, but the child born to Bathsheba from her experience with David died. David comforted Bathsheba and lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. Rumi and Yoga. Omid Safi, a professor of religion at Duke University who conducts Sufi meditation tours and retreats, said he sees young Muslims practicing yoga, mindfulness, and breathwork who are looking to integrate them with their religious identity. That, he said, comes from the recognition that Islam has its own tradition that goes back over 1,000 years, developed in conversation with Hindu and Buddhist traditions. Safi speaks of one fundamental Sufi practice of directing the breath into the subtle centers of perception in the human body, called lataif, similar to chakras in yoga, but with an important difference. In the Sufi model, it's a whirling model that whirls in your inner landscape and enters your heart, he said. It's not about pure transcendence, but balancing earth and heaven. Meditation has historically not been done in mosques, but adjacent to them, perhaps with an Islamic teacher leading a session of poetry, music, and meditation, Safi said. In the Sufi tradition, music is the sound of the movement of the celestial spheres, he added. Music is invisible, but you feel it in the heart. Poetry speaks in a symbolic language. The spiritual experiences we have are the same way. Catholic contemplative practices. Susan Stabil, a spiritual director who leads meditation retreats nationwide, said Catholic parishes are seeing a resurgence in contemplative practices, including meditation. Raised Catholic, Stabil became a Buddhist in her 20s and lived as a nun for a few years in Asia. She returned to Catholicism after marrying and having children. Stabil says Buddhism helped her better understand her Christian faith. Some in the Catholic tradition are suspicious of some of these contemplative practices, such as the centering prayer, she said, referring to a silent prayer developed in the 1970s by Catholic monastics as a way to deepen a relationship with God. She said that's because many Christians are unaware that early Christian hermits developed these practices. "I didn't know it was in my own tradition," she said. "No one had ever told me about it." Stabil says she's seeing more people wanting that deeper experience and desiring to learn about mysticism. "My hope is that more people will allow themselves to be transformed, she said, to live more fully in creation and the image and likeness of God.
This is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, January 15th. Brother-in-law's new squeeze is a familiar face. Dear Abby, please help me move forward. My brother-in-law is dating a woman my husband was intimate with once before we were married. It makes family functions very awkward for me, but most of the family sees it as the past. It was the past, but it is now in our faces. My husband feels the same way. Do we just keep the peace and stay away from functions as she seems to be more accepted than I am? We've been married 37 years. Are we being unreasonable? Signed, Confused in the East. Dear Confused, oh my, it seems like who goes around comes around. It's a shame that you can't leave the past, a one-night stand more than 37 years ago, in the past, and find the humor in this. I suspect it happens more often than you think. Please quit regarding this as a competition between you and your brother-in-law's girlfriend. Your husband chose you. End of contest. If there is a cause for embarrassment, it should be hers, not yours. Dear Abby, my wife Muriel and I have been together for 10 years and married for 7. She has worked in animal rescue for much of her life. Muriel thinks she has to save them all. No amount of explaining the financial and other consequences gets through to her. We currently have 21 pets living in our house. I have tried searching for support groups that might help, but to no avail. Even if I found such a group, my wife won't admit there is a problem. Can you help? Signed, Stumped in the Midwest. Dear Stumped, I'll try. I will also venture to say that 21 animals living in a house may not be healthy for all concerned. Because your wife is unable to listen to reason, contact animal control services in your city or county and explain what's going on. I'm surprised one of your neighbors hasn't already tipped them off. Your wife may have a heart of gold, but those creatures deserve a better standard of care than what your wife can give them. Dear Abby, I delivered mail for 36 years. For 25 of those years, my route was in a retirement community. I'm retired now, and it upsets me when I am not contacted when someone I was friendly with for 25 years passes away. This is happening more and more. Yes, I was their mail lady, but I was also their friend. I got to know and love all my customers. Their children knew who I was. The ones I was closest to are the ones whose death upset me the most because I wasn't notified. I know I'm not a relative, but it still hurts. If they read this, they will know who they are. I am not angry, I'm just hurt. Do you understand? Signed, Retired Mail Lady in Arizona. Dear Mail Lady, yes, I understand, and I also empathize with you. However, the children you describe may not have notified you about their parents' deaths because, unless they had your contact information, they didn't know how to reach you. Dear Abby is written by Abigail Van Buren, also known as Jean Phillips, and was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. Contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or Post Office Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.